This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. George Saunders, the acclaimed short story writer, has struck gold with his first novel, one based on an historical figure, Abraham Lincoln, but set in a mystical place between here and the hereafter. He joins us in just a few minutes. First, the NCAA's Board of Governors announced yesterday that it had reluctantly decided to resume scheduling college sporting events in North Carolina after last week's repeal and replacement of HB 2. But there are some strings attached, and we're going to talk about those and about some reaction to this decision with the Charlotte Business Journal's senior staff writer, Eric Spanberg. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And with us by phone is the CEO of the Charlotte Chamber, Bob Morgan. Thank you for joining us, Bob. I appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning. The swiftness of the HB 2 repeal moments before the NCAA's deadline for making their decision on playoff games through 2022 came with no guarantee that they would reinstate these games. In fact, yesterday's statement doesn't guarantee that they will reinstate these games, Eric. So when the announcement came yesterday, was there a surprise in this at all?
Well, I think the surprise is one of the words that you just mentioned, which is reluctantly voted to allow consideration. That's what the NCAA said about reconsidering North Carolina as a site for championships and tournaments. And, you know, the NCAA clearly is not happy with this law. They are begging to find a reason not to come back. But I think they realize that in the end, North Carolina is close enough to being in line with other states that they can't say that.
Reluctantly stuck out like a sore thumb when I read it yesterday. I mean, that's a pretty strong word. And if they were reluctant to allow North Carolina as a site for their games, and they're looking for reasons not to come back until a clean repeal is achieved, why did they do it? Bob Morgan, who was twisting their arm? You guys?
Well, I think they've been part of the discussion all along of, HB2 is a problem, and they have had great success with their events in North Carolina. I think the reality is what we have from last week, House Bill 142, is a bipartisan compromise that repeals HB2, replaces it, is far from perfect. But we saw last week there is a political center still in North Carolina, when the governor and the speaker and the Senate president come together, there's a solution that has made neither side, left nor right, pleased. The opposition was vehement on both sides last week. But I think for the NCAA, there's a reality that it's North Carolina in the news today and for the past year. But we're not the only one. They see this issue's coming up in Texas and likely other states. So we certainly applaud the NCAA and the ACC and look forward to now being able to compete to bring them back.
Well, maybe not, because it may not happen. Eric, they used the word reluctantly. They went on to say that although the previous games slated here for 2017 and 18 will be played, game sites will have to, quote, submit additional documentation demonstrating how student athletes and fans will be protected from discrimination. What does that mean?
Well, I think they're looking for assurances, for example, with Spectrum Center, even though under the HB 2, you know, it qualifies as a government-owned building, they would be able to set their own bathroom policy. They would have even under HB 2, and certainly now with the new law, they will be able to. And so the NCAA and the ACC and others are going to ask for guarantees that that will be carried out, that there will be restrooms for everyone. And
can these sites make those guarantees?
Yes,
under
they
this
can.
Currently,
because yes, they can.
In their statement, the NCAA says this new law restores the state to the legal landscape that existed prior to HB 2, which is similar to other jurisdictions presently hosting NCAA championships. Well, that begs the question. If it's similar to other jurisdictions, why are they reluctantly returning?
Well, I think that, again, they don't like, for example, the three-year moratorium on establishing local ordinances. They don't like the fact that you still exclude people with lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender characteristics from non-discrimination protection in state law. That's still not protected in North Carolina. Those are things that they outlined when they said originally, we're not going to stage our events here because 1, 2, 3, 4. So they didn't get everything they wanted. And I think the other thing they're trying to do is send out a warning shot that, hey, if you try to monkey further with any legislation that creeps into this territory, we'll go right back out of here.
They also say that this new law has, quote, minimally achieved a situation where we believe NCAA championships may be conducted in a non-discriminatory environment. So are they saying that the rest of the states in which they have games are also achieving a minimum level of protections against discrimination? Are they, in essence, pushing for more, or are they just settling for less?
Well, now we're delving into territory of NCAA language, which itself can be rather vexing. So,
hire a writer.
They should. We should get someone who's maybe written a best-selling novel, short stories.
Go ahead, Bob.
The question of kind of the word reluctance. Let's be eyes wide open that organizations like the NCAA and others are still under incredible pressure from groups on both sides of this issue who will threaten to jeopardize the success of their events. And we've seen a bizarre circumstance in the economic development business of trying to recruit companies and jobs. We have lost jobs as a result of HB2. At the same time, we had more announced new jobs in 16 than we had in 15, and we have a busy book of business right now. We've had four companies, including one as recently as last week. They are coming to Charlotte. They are actually expanding in Charlotte, several hundred jobs. They're not going to announce it. They don't want to tell anybody because the political groups on both sides of the spectrum want to engage. They want to put pressure on companies. They want to put pressure on the NCAA. That part of the battle is probably going to be with us for a while.
Well, you're clearly happy with the fact that the NCAA is coming back. I'm sure you're happy that the ACC is coming back. We're waiting for the other shoe to drop. That would be the NBA. That's going to probably happen sometime before the end of this week or next. But are you happy with the compromise, Bob Morgan? Are you happy with HB 142, which repealed HB 2?
Well, I don't know. Happy is the right word. We still think that municipalities ought to be able to extend protections to the LGBT community. We frankly would prefer to see a national definition. There was a court of appeals ruling out of Chicago yesterday that might find its way to the Supreme Court and might help provide a national definition. I am very excited and happy that there is a political center that you had. If you step back from the personal and professional pain of the damage that's been done over the last year, it was a fascinating negotiating conundrum of, with fierce opposition on the left, fierce opposition on the right, how do you come together? And even though you had the governor and the speaker and the Senate president, you still had to get the majority votes of the rank-and-file members from both parties. And there was a lot of drama in the legislature Thursday as the debate took place and those votes happened. But the headlines that we're reading nationally, North Carolina repeals HB2, NCAA says we can now compete. We're able to look forward now. We're going to talk in our business with economic development clients. We can quit talking about bathrooms and we can talk about
that's the problem here, because we've always talked about bathrooms. That's not what this is about, and everybody knows it. It's not about bathrooms. The NCAA says it's not about bathrooms. The ACC says it's not about bathrooms. And four cities and five states are keeping their policy of banning travel to North Carolina because they believe the law that replaced HB2 is inadequate to ensure non-discrimination. What about that, Bob?
I'm not going to speak for those other cities. There are folks on the left, there are folks on the right who are opposed to any kind of a compromise. We saw a compromise, bipartisan compromise repeal. HB 142 is far from perfect. It is much better than HB2, and it allows us to move forward. The conversation with our clients is different today than it has been for the past year, and we can sell our assets rather than have to talk so much about HB2.
Governor Cooper, Eric, indicated he was pleased with the decision that was reached yesterday by the NCAA, but he said we will continue our work to fight for statewide anti-discrimination protections for LGBT North Carolinians. Given the compromises that were already made in making the repeal itself, what action is possible with the legislature?
I don't think any action is possible with the legislature. Remember, he had to beg, stomp, and scream to get this far, and he has a 3-year moratorium. So really, unless 2018 is very, propitious for Democrats, he doesn't have any wiggle room. So you know, when he spoke after the compromise was approved, he all but held his nose, and he even made a remark at one point, you know, in a perfect world where there's a good General Assembly. Well, I mean, that's telling you that he knows he does not have any further that he can reach. He wants to go further, right, but he can't get there.
In their statement, the NCAA also says, and I'm going to read this now, it's long, "We have been assured by the state that this new law allows the NCAA to enact its inclusive policies by contract with communities, universities, arenas, hotels, and other service providers that are doing business with us, our students, other participants, and fans. Further, outside of bathroom facilities, the new law allows our campuses to maintain their own policies against discrimination, including protecting LGBTQ rights, and allows cities' existing non-discrimination ordinances, including LGBTQ protections, to remain effective." Exactly what are the NCAA's inclusiveness policies, and when did they start pushing those policies?
I don't have an exact date of when they started pushing those policies, but all of that language is pointing toward we're not going to allow anyone to be shoved aside. It's much like what you see in city government, county government, where you have to be fair and give small businesses, vendors, the opportunity to compete for business, including, in this case, as they're pointing out very clearly, LGBT groups. And so that's what they're trying to establish. They're trying to do everything they can to nudge as much inclusiveness as they can while still coming to North Carolina.
The NCAA, Bob, that statement I just read, points out that the new law allows cities' existing non-discrimination ordinances, including LGBTQ protections, to remain in place. Well, Charlotte, in a good faith gesture, repealed the ordinance that led to HB2, so we don't have those protections, and HB 142 prohibits us from reinstating that. Should we ask for a mulligan? The Masters starts today. Should we ask for a mulligan?
What do you mean, a mulligan?
A do-over, if that's the right term. Is that that's
yes, good yes, that
is that
yes.
The right term? Don't you play golf? You're at the chamber.
There is the three-year moratorium or cooling off period, if you will. We still believe that that municipalities ought to be allowed to go further than the state in offering protections to the LGBT community. That's a part of this debate, discussion that's going to have to be fought as we go forward. I think Eric's right. There's an election in 2018. There'll be another one in 2020. I think we're not going to see anything certainly in the next year or so beyond what we saw passed last week with House Bill 142.
HB2 unquestionably damaged the state's reputation and by extension Charlotte to a certain degree, although I think the state has overshadowed Charlotte and all of this in the national media. How do you repair our brand, Bob?
Well, you begin with education. You want people to understand what happened last week. How is that different than HB2? You want to celebrate decisions like that from the ACC, that from the NCAA. You want to get back to the business of selling the assets of Charlotte and of North Carolina. I'm a bit, misery loves company. I think we're going to see other states. Texas seems to be headed down an eyes wide open path of following what they saw happen in North Carolina last year.
And this may, I have to stop because we're out of time, Bob Morgan, CEO of the Charlotte Chamber, but this may be decided by the courts because the Seventh Court of Appeals has already decided that LGBTQ protections are provided by the Civil Rights Act. Eric Spanberg, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
As well. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and H&S Roofing and Gutter Company, providing roofing and gutter services for residential and commercial customers in the Carolinas since 1939. More information at hsroofing.com. And Cat Wealth Consulting LLC. Martha Cat is a financial advisor specializing in retirement planning for State of North Carolina employees. Online at cattwealth.com. Well, the Charlotte School of Law is facing serious troubles. The job of studying the school has fallen to Scott Boyles, a faculty member and former federal prosecutor, and he will be here tomorrow to talk about righting the ship. And then we hear from Tom Nichols from the U.S. Naval War College about something he's very concerned about, the death of expertise and the rise of a cult of ignorance bred by the Internet and social media. I'm there. That's tomorrow at 9.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, President Trump has predicted a very difficult meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. We'll unpack what's on the table and at stake for both countries. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. On listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. George Saunders is well-known for his short stories. Critics just can't say enough nice things about him. Time magazine has called him the best short story writer in English, not one of, not arguably, but the best. He's been a National Book Award finalist. His latest book is on the New York Times bestseller list. And Stephen Colbert likes him so much, he seems to be on The Late Show all the time.
My next guest is a MacArthur Genius Fellow and quite possibly my favorite living author. Please welcome George Saunders. Nice to see you again.
Nice. You said quite possibly.
Quite possibly. Quite possibly.
Whatever.
I have to check with my other living authors right now. I might have them on at another time, and I have to be able to say the same introduction
it's
for
fine.
Them.
It's fine. It's
all
fine.
Right? I can't be painted into a corner here, George.
And did I mention CPCC's Censorious Celebration of Literature and the Arts likes him, too? Well, he's speaking there today twice, 10:30 this morning to talk about kindness. I can't even say the word after HB2 interviewed. And then again tonight at 8 to discuss switching gears from short stories to novels with his new book, Lincoln in the Bardo. Both of those events will be at CPCC's Halton Theater. But first, he gives us the opportunity to see if we like him too, because he's spending the rest of the hour with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to Charlotte. Clearly, Stephen Colbert likes you. And it strikes me that the last time I remember authors being on late-night television with any frequency, and you're evidently on there a lot, has either been Jon Stewart or Jack Parr and Johnny Carson in the very, very early years. What's going on here? I mean, is this the resurgence of intelligence in late-night television?
Or something, yeah. No. Well, Stephen's been really good to writers, and lately Seth Meyers is having a few of us on,
right,
too, so he's got to sort of pull our weight.
You know, I've had several authors on here when Oprah was still on television, and some of them had their books chosen by Oprah to be part of her book club, and they said that when that happened, their lives changed because book sales went through the roof.
Yeah.
They were no longer marginal, even if they were big sellers. They were big sellers now. Does late night television help you?
Colbert does, for sure. Yeah, there's a Colbert bounce.
Really?
Yeah, and beyond that, I just loved the idea that, you know, a writer isn't considered some kind of freak, you know, that you can actually entertain the idea that literature is important for us and that it's actually not out of the mainstream as part of what we do as human beings. So I was
plus you at some point into some interviewer, you said that growing up you didn't know that you could make a living writing.
No.
Now you're walking out on the Colbert Show.
Yeah.
People are seeing a writer walking out on the music's playing and the people are screaming and you're walking into the light, and that must mean something to people who are out there who may harbor a fascination for writing.
I hope so. I hope, you know, because literature has always been something that people turn to when they're trying to be smarter, trying to be bigger hearted. So it's a different skill set there. I mean, I don't think Henry James would have been a great talk show guest, but I think, you know, to the extent that you can, it's good to get out there.
Well, what is that like? I mean, you have to, you know, walking into a late night television show, you're a writer. It's a very solitary profession. What is it like to suddenly have to walk out there and be on?
Yeah.
How do they prep you for that?
Usually there's not much. You know, there's usually a little bit of, you know, the host is interested in ABC, and then I kind of go off on my own and think about it and think, well, okay, if I had to talk in a five-minute burst about the three things that are most important to me, what would they be? And then you kind of wait for the question and try to respond in real time. He makes it really easy, though. He's, you know, they say he's a host, and he really is. He's so generous, really wants you to succeed, and he's also very watchful. He's watching you closely to see what, you know, what might work, and it's a lot of fun, actually.
I've talked to some writers of short stories before, and they always say that writing short stories is really difficult.
Yeah.
And that's what you chose to spend most of your career doing, writing short stories. Why are you...
Masochist. Yeah, early on it was just I wrote one novel when we were first married, and it was a family disaster. It took me a year and ended up being a complete flop. So it was partly just survival. You know, we had little kids and I was working. So you could maybe imagine writing a pretty good 5-page story in a month or two. So it was kind of just the size that fit my lifestyle.
But it's hard because you have to compact a lot of information and character development and plot development into a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
But you said that when you sat down to write this book, Lincoln and the Bardo, you hoped it wouldn't turn out to be a novel.
Yeah, I mean, I had a pretty good shtick going about why I never wanted to write a novel. But I mean, you know, this. But
wasn't
this,
that easier? You have more time, more space.
No, you don't, though. I mean, I think a writer has a basic DNA, you know, a basic pace they have to do, and mine is quick. So even though this is a novel, it's a pretty short novel, actually, and it works a lot like a story, you know. I think this whole storytelling ethic is a bit like a joke. Joke mentality, you know, you get to the end and there's either a payoff or not, and everybody knows whether there is or not. So that makes a lot of pressure to be not only succinct, but for me it means I have to do hundreds of drafts to get through the stupid stuff first so I can get down to the essence of what the story is.
I want to get back to this thing about people seeing writers on television in late night and maybe inspiring them to realize that that is a way you can make a living, and it is a way to exercise creative juices, and maybe that is a viable path for me in my life. You grew up in Amarillo, Texas, as I understand it. You were born in Amarillo. You grew up in Chicago. You barely, so this is, these are your words, you barely graduated from the Colorado School of Mines, not Mimes, Mines, M-I-N-E-S, with a degree in exploration geophysics.
You're speechless.
How did you go from that to being a short story?
Well, kind of gradually and then all at once. I wasn't that great of an engineer. I had a couple of high school teachers who literally got me into college, and I admired them so much. And he was a geologist, so I thought I'd follow in his footsteps. And then when I got there, I was sort of a C-plus student, maybe, you know, but always was sneaking off to read and write on the side. So at some point, I went to work in Asia. In the oil fields. And while I was there, I had this kind of epiphany that I really wanted to write, you know. And so then I kind of had to start over from the bottom.
Yeah, you were I read the oil fields and the jungles of Sumatra.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was kind of wonderful. I'd never been out of the country before. So, and at that point, I was kind of a right winger. And I went over to Asia and had my eyes opened by a lot of stuff, by the generosity and the poverty and the way the world really works. So it was terrific. We'd work 4 weeks on and then have 2 weeks off with complete freedom to go. So I went to Russia, went to Thailand, went to...
So you were a right winger. You're not now.
No. I'm left of Gandhi at this point.
So what happened to you? Where did you go wrong?
Well, honestly, what actually happened was I was sort of an Ayn Rand right winger, you know, that everyone had to be – the misfortune was a sign of some kind of misguided nature. So there was one evening, actually, I was out drinking in Singapore and feeling pretty good about myself, and walked by this big hotel excavation and saw some motion in there. And I looked in, and there was like 300 elderly Malaysian women moving rocks by hand. And somehow that, you know, I grew up working class, so that kind of threw a switch in my head, and I thought, oh yeah, so actually we can get bad luck in a lot of different ways. You know, it's not all about virtue being 100% rewarded. And so then with that switch thrown, I started kind of looking around a little bit more thoughtfully.
You know, you're not the only person who points to Ayn Rand and says that's where my political philosophy has come from. But she was a writer. She was not.
Yeah.
How would you describe her?
Well, I her book. I mean, I went to college because of
that. She wrote Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah,
Atlas Shrugged.
I went to college because of that book. It was just the first intellectual shot fired across my bow in a long time when I was 18. I think actually now that when I read her now, I cringe a little bit because she does a lot of, in my view, a lot of falsifying of reality to propagate a political view.
So that's where it comes from.
Well, yeah, but in real fiction writing, you know, not that she's not a real fiction writer, but in fiction writing that I like better. There's a lot more writing in order to explore what reality is like. You don't come in with a preconceived idea. You try to come in with no ideas, and then the actual line-by-line progress teaches you about reality.
Right. You also have – you've done so many things in your life, odd jobs from a doorman to a roofer to a convenience store clerk. How many of the experiences that you personally had as a result of all these jobs and the people that you met or observed in those jobs – find their way in some cases, not verbatim, but in in your writing.
Yeah, not so many in a linear way, but basically my feeling is, as a writer, you go out and you try to get roughed up by the world. You try to put yourself in situations high, low, comfortable, uncomfortable. And then when you get to the moment of invention, you're smarter, you know. So to have been genuinely poor, to have been worked physical jobs that were really crushing, also to have hung out with truly rich people, or to do all that stuff, right. When you go to make something up, you're going to be more truthful.
Because you lived, did you not, for a while in a what's the word I'm looking for? A homeless, with homeless people.
Yeah.
Did you do that to write an article? Or
I wrote a piece for GQ, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
On that. What was that like?
Oh, it was beautiful, terrifying. You know, it was in Fresno, and I actually inadvertently set my tent up in the middle of between two crack dens. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was going to be sort of this Steinbeckian playing guitar kind of thing, and it was, playing guitar on the campfire. But it was really frightening, and of course,
frightening because they were frightening?
No, just because it was a very, rough situation. I mean, there were a lot of addicted people, a lot of mentally ill people, and you could just feel that, you know, the usual armor I bring as a college professor and a person of some means, they didn't care. And they didn't know. I was sort of incognito. So you could see the real rawness of that life. And the interesting thing is it brings up all kinds of things in you. Like, I'm a big advocate for kindness. Well, in that situation, I just had my guard up all the time. And all of those kind of bourgeois virtues that I always trumpeting about were really put to the test because I was so concerned about getting knifed, basically.
Wow. I understand. I don't know these are facts, but you became an avid writer because of being in the jungles of Sumatra. There's nothing to do in your off time, so you would just load up your knapsack with as many books as you could consume and read them, and then in 2 or 3 weeks later, you'd go back and buy more books.
Yeah.
Because there was nothing else to do. Most writers are readers, are they not?
Because I think so.
Yeah. How does that help you with and influence you without you becoming a parrot?
Well, I think you do become a parrot. When I was young, I was a very good Hemingway parrot, for example. I think that's one of the stages you work through. First, you find a hero. You see the world through his or her eyes. You do that for a number of years. It's kind of a good skill-building thing. And then at some point, it starts to nauseate you because your actual knowledge of the world that you've acquired in a hard way can't get there in someone else's voice. So there's a beautiful critical moment that happens where you just are tired of parroting, and you have to go into that scary ground of trying to find your own voice.
Somehow you found your way to Syracuse, to the MFA program, and became in the creative writing department, and became a student. Graduated. Now you teach there. You're a professor there, and you say you have taught some of the most remarkable young American writers in the last 15 years. Are you teaching them, or just helping them chisel off the rough edges of natural talent? Because, I mean, I guess the question is, can writing be taught?
Yeah. At that level, you don't have to do that. We get 650 applications a year for 6 places. So when they come, they're already amazing. What you're trying to do is sort of psychologically mentor them to do the thing that only they can do.
And you said, I let everybody do what they want.
Yeah.
Can that really be true? I mean, you're a teacher.
You do. You let them get to the end of the tether, and then you let them feel the snap a little bit sometimes. Mm-hmm. Also, I just do a lot of line editing because often if a person has some issue, whether it's technical or aesthetic or psychological, you can't really talk about it from the outside in, but you can edit your way into it. So let's say somebody is parroting somebody else too much. You can edit that closely to show where they actually want to depart from their heroes. I had a kid who was imitating David Foster Wallace. Well, spent 2 hours on one page, and you could see that exactly where he was trying to not be David Foster Wallace within that text. But he couldn't see it until we line edited it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're essentially the editor that you would have as a going when you go to be to get published.
Right. Right.
People don't like editors.
They learn to. You know, real writers learn to love editors. If you know, that's always the kind of the crossroads moment is, if you don't like being edited, you're probably in the wrong job. And especially if you don't like being self-edited, because my whole mantra is revision is actually 100% of the game.
Yeah, what is your process? Do you just sit down in front of a blank page, a blank computer screen, and start writing, or just let it flow and then go back and change it?
Something like that. I mean, for me, when I think about writing, it's taking what I wrote yesterday on hard copy and just reading it and almost imagining there's a meter in your head, and this side says P for positive, this is N for negative. And the whole job is, as you're reading your own stuff, you're watching that arrow. Like, what would a first-time reader be thinking? Mm. If you're in the positive, that's great. Every so often it drops into the negative, and that's where the work begins. You know, you have to sort of say, well, first of all, don't deny that it did, and then say, why do we think that this, you know, page six suddenly became boring, you know, and then marking it up to fix it, putting it in, and just do that over and over again, many, many hundreds of iterations.
You made your bona fides on short stories and short story writing. Is there an appetite for that among publishers and among readers for short stories, maybe more so today than ever before because we're so crunched for time?
Yeah, also the creative writing programs have made a market for because that's the easiest thing to teach. But it is, because in the format of a workshop, it's easier to work on a 15-page story. But still, I mean, having written my first novel now, the short story is a really cool esoteric form. It takes, you have to have read quite a number of them to really enjoy them all the way. So I think they'll always be a little bit less sellable than a novel, but it's an exquisite form that once you get the taste for it, it's really, I think it's probably the most truthful way of talking about the way life actually unfolds for us.
So when you sit down and write a short story or you put together a collection, in your mind, is there a theme that runs through those short stories, those collections, or is it just a scattershot?
There is a theme, but it's you discover it by putting it together. You know, my model is you're trying to know as little as possible in advance of everything. You know, the idea is your conceptual mind is a little dumber than your subconscious mind. So you start a story not knowing what it's going to be about. It tells you. Likewise, a collection. You've worked really hard for 5 years. Everything that's got above a certain bar, you put it together, and the stories start cross-talking. And even up to the very last day, the book is teaching you what it's about.
You start writing a story, and you don't know what the story is about.
Right.
So what are you writing?
You don't know. You actually don't.
Yeah. Well, you have to start somewhere.
Well, you do. You start with something. I mean, I start with something that's interesting to me for reasons that I don't understand fully. And also something that feels like, yeah, I could do something with this. Just that slight notion. Then you start poking at it a little bit by revising, trying to make it better. And weirdly, it will often kick out a plot twist. Not because you wanted it to. It'll also kick out a politics, not because you want it to, but just almost like in biology when you had those seed crystals. You know, you start with one, organically it'll actually grow out to something bigger. So there's a great quote. Einstein said, no worthy problem is ever solved in the plane of its original conception. So the idea is you start a story not knowing what it is, or maybe you think you know a little bit, but the magic moment is when the story says, you don't know me well enough. I've got bigger plans for you than you know about. So that's a cool job.
So many writers have said and have told me on this program that sometimes their characters take on a life of their own. They're sitting there, they're writing, and suddenly the character does something, and you go, oh. Mm. Do you understand that?
Yeah. It happens through technical means. You know, you're trying to make a sentence better, and suddenly the sentence adjusts itself, and there's a new person in front of you. So that's what I love about it, is the implication that there's a part of your mind, part of our minds, that we don't use on an everyday basis because it takes a lot of gestation time. But if you've been working on a story for a year, there's all kinds of things going on off stage that you don't even know about. And what I love about it is the person that I end up being on the page after all that revision is smarter than I am, mm-hmm. nicer than I am, funnier than I am, more comfortable with ambiguity, you know.
The germ of an idea, when something comes into your head and you say, oh, I can use that, that's going to launch us into the conversation when we come back from the break about your book, Lincoln in the Bardo, because it came from an idea in riding in a car, and it gestated for a long time before it became a book. George Saunders is our guest. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar. New location now open at The View in downtown Charlotte near BB&T Ballpark. Full portfolio of wine and beer from all over the world, plus live music. Details at thescrewcrew.com. And Wild Birds Unlimited, bringing people and nature together with bird feeding and nature products. Located at the Galleria off Independence and Huntersville, exit 25, online at charlotte.wbu.com. President Trump has predicted a very difficult meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. And on point today, we'll talk about what's on the table and at stake for both countries in that upcoming meeting. That's coming up in 20 minutes to 10 o'clock, and we will continue our conversation with George Saunders, author of Lincoln in the Bardo, in just a moment. Stay with us.
Mm-hmm. Some schools say they're seeing higher incidences of hate speech and racially motivated attacks, and many are struggling with how to handle it.
You know, this one was one that they don't teach you in administration 101 classes. There's no playbook for this one now.
How schools and students are responding to hate, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, George Saunders, author of Lincoln in the Bardo. That's his first novel, which is doing incredibly well. He's also the author of several collections of short stories, including 10th of December, Civil War Land in Bad Decline. What a great name. Persuasion Nation and others. You may have read him in the GQ or in the New Yorker. He writes for those publications as well, and he's here today to speak at 10:30 this morning, moments from now, on kindness at Sensoria at the CPCC in the Halton Theater, and at 8 o'clock tonight at Lincoln in about Lincoln in the Bardo in the Halton. They're both are free, and information about all of this is on our website at wfae.org. So you were driving, as I'm told, with your sister-in-law,
My wife and her cousin, actually.
Okay, yeah. In a car past a cemetery in Georgetown in Washington, and she just happened to say, oh, over there, Willie Lincoln was...
Yeah, she pointed up on the hillside, and there was a little sad little crypt there, and she said that Willie Lincoln was buried there for 3 years, and this is the part that got me. Lincoln apparently was so heartbroken that he went into the crypt on several occasions to hold the body or to view the body when he was president. So that was 20-something years ago.
And we know that's true?
We know it was reported in the papers that he had done that. Okay. So it's reported in different ways.
So yeah. When she said that to you, did you go, oh, I could do a book?
I did, and then I immediately said, no, I can't. Because I had, at that time, I think I had one book out, and the first books are kind of first-person, funny, kind of satirical, almost sci-fi kind of things. And I just couldn't see any link-up between the way I was writing then in that story. So I kind of thought, okay, that's for somebody else. Too bad, yeah. You know. And I just put it off consistently for the next 20 years.
But when did you decide I'm going to do it?
About 2012. 10th of December was done, and I was in that kind of weird period where the book's finished and you're just waiting for it to come out. And I thought, well, maybe I could just, you know, give myself a three-month contract to try this stretch, you know. And at that point in my life, I was, you know, 50-something, and it felt important. You know, you could either sort of say, no, it's too hard for me, I won't try it, and then enact a kind of artistic death spiral, or you could just take the shot.
And you didn't know it was a novel when you started, and you were hoping that it wouldn't.
Yeah.
So that tells me that you were thinking that it would be somehow, for some reason.
Yeah.
Why?
I could feel – I mean, there was a lot there. You know, my plan was to do sort of one night in the graveyard. And even from the first few pages, it just didn't feel like it had story DNA. It seemed like it wanted to push out beyond that. I finished about a third of it and gave it to my wife after about 2 years. And she was like, yeah, this is good.
2 years.
Yeah, it's slow. But, so I was rooting for it not to be a novel because I didn't want it to be sort of, you know, chubby.
So many people may not know what Bardo is because I didn't know what it meant. And I heard a conversation you had, I think, with Tom Ashbrook, and it was just peripheral in the back of my – I was doing other things. And I didn't hear the explanation. And even when it was over, I thought, well, okay, so what's the Bardo?
Bardo is a Tibetan word that means transitional state. So it really, the way it's used here is
like purgatory.
It's like purgatory, except it's a little less harsh. You know, I mean, I was raised Catholic, and our purgatory was, you know, go sit on a hard bench until the end of days, you know.
But you know it's over. You know it's coming to an end.
Yeah, that's right.
Catholic tradition.
Right. And actually, in the strictly defined Bardo, I think that's 49 days.
Okay.
But it's a transition between the moment you die, it starts, and it ends with whatever comes next.
So is the title... Does it have a double meaning? I know that Willie Lincoln he's the deceased person in this. Mm-hmm. So he's in the Bardo. He's waiting to go on to his next position in the afterlife.
Right.
But is Lincoln also in the Bardo?
Yeah.
Because he is incredible mourning.
Yeah. This is the kid that he loved the most, the kid who was most like him, and that illness and the death came very quickly when he had his mind on other things. So I think my sense was he's the second Lincoln in the Bardo, and it's transition between fatherhood and not in this case, but also between, you know, he's got to go back to this incredible war that he's botching, and he's got to try to pull it out, and he's basically got, you know, a few days to make that transition.
Now, I got to tell you, I have not read the book because I don't have the book, and I didn't know you were coming here until about 20 minutes ago.
No, relationship is perfect.
in the scheme of things. But one of the things, I joke about this because I have to read a lot, and when the producers hand me a book, the first thing I do is open it and look at the size of the type and how widely spaced the lines are. And if it's big type and widely spaced, I'm happy,
right?
Because I can make a quick read of it, and Stephen Colbert jokingly opened the book on camera and pointed it toward the camera, and there's a lot of white space.
A lot of white space.
Kind of book.
Yeah.
But it turns out that the reason for that is the construction of the book itself. You use is it almost exclusively epigraphs?
It's all monologue. Yes, okay. It's 200 or 300 separate monologue pieces.
I don't want you to give too much away. You can do what you want here. But as I understand it, Lincoln is in the crypt with Willie, holding the body, and around him, he's unaware of this, are all these ghosts who are also in the bardo, waiting to leave.
Yeah, you know, I had the problem of who, you know. So Lincoln comes into the graveyard at night. Who narrates it?
Right.
So it could be Lincoln, in which case you get like 4 score and 7 minutes ago. That's no good. Or it could be, maybe it's a gravedigger who's staying late. That doesn't really make sense. So I hit on this idea of having the story told by all these spirits who are kind of unhappily trapped in this bardo. And so it turned out to be this almost like a screenplay. It looks like a play text, sort of like that. Yeah.
And they're commenting on all kinds of things. In their past lives, their alive lives, and in their lives waiting to go on to the next thing. And one of the things that struck me that I did read was that one of the ghosts says, "No one has ever held us before," because he's in there holding his dead son.
Yeah.
You abandon the body and you move on with life.
Yeah, and when I was researching ghosts, one of the things that was so touching was some of the parapsychologists say that ghosts are lonely. They like it when you have a picture of the person they were on the desk. They don't like it when you use, for example, their gravestone as a foundation stone. So this kind of beautiful image of people who aren't able to move on for whatever reason still being heavily invested in being alive. And so in the book, the dead are sort of like they're all in denial that they're dead. They know something's changed, and they know they're kind of missing the party a little bit, and they really long to get back. So this moment when a living, breathing person actually honors one of them with his attention is huge for them. It kind of changes everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
Lincoln is an historical figure, and I would think that that provides problems and challenges for a writer, because you're mixing in some fact, as we know it, with the fiction that you have created. Does it worry you that people will read this book who are not up on everything Lincoln or Civil War or 1862 and think, wow, that's true?
Well, I assume they would do that. So I try to really stay within the bounds of what actually happened or what could have happened or should have happened. And so you're always doing this kind of thing where you're bound by the historical facts, but where else are you going to get Lincoln's thoughts but from yourself? You know, so you do that kind of melding of my experiences as a father and even as a teacher and as a person, and you're kind of melting that down and putting it into a cast that is Lincoln. But I had, when I was writing it, I had a picture of Willie and a picture of Lincoln over my desk just to remind myself that those are real people and this was a real loss. And so I think kind of making sure that you're respectful in that way is kind of a good protection.
The 1860s, people in that time period, as I understand it, were preoccupied with death and the afterlife and searching for them. Mary Todd Lincoln used to hold seances in the White House, I guess, to talk to Willie and later on to Tad, who also died. And we know that she was clinically depressed for much of her time in the White House. We know that Lincoln carried the terrible burden of prosecuting a civil war which had brother against brother. The specter of death was everywhere. Does that play into this?
It does. I think I read somewhere that if you upscaled the populations, like 20 million of contemporary people would have died to enact the same proportion of death. So everybody had somebody that they lost, and you could see that the culture became really interested in it. To me, that this, I mean, at some point the book switched, and it was started out being about the dead, and then, as you hope will happen in a work of fiction, it became about life. How, you know, yeah. So the ghosts are all kind of in denial about their true state. You know, as I think we are, and in the end, I think they find that. The whole job is to rouse themselves, or as Lincoln said, disenthrall themselves and try to take stock of what's actually happening. And in the book, it not by my design, but what happens is becoming aware of the situation actually makes them more loving towards one another and towards Willie, which is kind of a surprise dividend. I didn't see that coming in the book at all. But then, of course, you think, well, yeah, that's like life.
You know, today, when we look back on some of the things I've read about Lincoln in the time period, and particularly Mary Todd Lincoln, who was really preoccupied with this, a lot of people then had this macabre fascination with death. And you would think that going into the tomb and holding the body of your dead son, cold, stiff, not human anymore, is macabre. But you have called it a charged and gorgeous thing to have done.
Well, you know, partly if you think about the way we think about death, you've got this person that you've loved your whole life, been intimate with, cared about, protected. That person dies, and our mentality is get that thing out of here. That's kind of macabre when you think about it. You know, the idea that life is like an on-off switch. Most traditions say not so. That actually death is a sort of a gradual process, and when the person you love dies, it would be kind of weird if that body wasn't still a little dear to you. You know, it's been dear to you all along. So I think in some ways they had a more high-functioning view of death. You know, Lincoln presumably went in there because that thing reminded him so acutely of that thing that he had loved.
Funeral parlors are called funeral parlors because the body used to be in the parlor at your home. They weren't as afraid of death or
and you did the preparation.
About yourself as a writer, you have said that you have, and I'm going to quote here, a modest little talent garden. So that means I have to be very smart about how I work it to try to get the most out of it and to sort of trick it. I can only get certain material to come alive, so that requires me being very crafty. And you told Mother Jones, when you're writing, you try to evade suckiness. And by it's a great word. And by maximally evading suckiness, you might come up with something original. You don't give yourself much credit, do you?
No, I'm a lapsed Catholic, so I've got a very active inner nun. No, I think that's good practice, you know, to be a little skeptical of your abilities is kind of a good practice. It means you set the bar high and you go back to things again and again to try to. I mean, for me, it's mostly a process of trying to imagine the reader as being a really wonderful, intelligent, worldly person that I'm trying to please. It's hard, and it should be. That relationship should be intimate and should be almost sacred, that every time I write something, I should be thinking of you and going, huh, I wonder if I'm being boring. I wonder if I'm phoning this in. I wonder if I'm underestimating my reader in any essential way.
So what kind of creative material is it that you know you can deal with or that that's the stuff I should be writing?
I know it when I see it. That's the hardest part. I wish I could give you a one-line answer, but basically there's a lot of moving targets. You're changing as a person. The world is changing. So really the strangest skill set is just to say, when an idea comes to me, even if it's just a few lines of dialogue, does the heart leap at it or not? Mm. If it does, and partly that the feeling is, I don't know what that is. I don't know why that interests me. That's the best thing. When my mind starts saying, oh, that's about patriarchy, then I know I'm in trouble. You know, when you think you know why something's important, it's like love, you know. When you see somebody across a crowded room, the heart leaps. That's good enough. That's a good reason to start.
This book is about death and life, Lincoln and the Bardo. Do you write a lot about death?
I think I do, yeah. I've heard that I do.
Because one of the things that you're addressing in Lincoln is death and the fact that no matter how vital we all are, how permanent we think of ourselves as being, death is pursuing us and it's going to catch up at some point in the future. Does it help for us, do you think, to come to terms with that?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I think that a truly joyful life lies on the other side of that realization. You know, you can make a happy life in a spirit of death denial. And I've done that so far, you know. But every so often you get a look over the fence. And I think, you know, the people I know who are really wise are people who know very well that they're temporary. And somehow, in spite of that, have found a way to lead expansive, generous
lives. So is the message here that letting go can be freeing?
And I would be I'm not a big message person. I mean, for me, the message of the book is that when for an hour afterwards, your head should be spinning.
You talked about being right-wing and Ayn Rand fan, et cetera, early on in your life. Now you're on the other side of the political spectrum, but you wrote an article, I think it was for GQ, about Donald Trump, and you went to a lot of Donald Trump rallies, and you talked to people who were supporting him, and you found out that they had one thing in common, a lot of them, kindness. Mm. I mean, when you got them away from politics, they were nice people.
Yeah.
And you're speaking today about kindness. What did you see in those people that reminded yourself of you when you were right wing?
Oh, basically,
not
I think
that they're all right wing. Some of them are not.
Yeah, yeah. I think you know what I found a lot of things terrifying during that reporting, but one of the things I found encouraging was that we have very good public manners in America. Mostly, we have what we understand. We have shared values of gentleness, sense of humor. Not being too full of yourself.
Volunteerism.
Yeah, yeah. So that was hopeful to me. And the people that I met were very willing to talk. They knew I was a liberal. They were, I'm sure, somewhat afraid I'd throw them under the bus. But I found it reassuring that there is actually a centralist view when you actually go out on the street.
Yeah.
I think that we could talk for hours about why that doesn't pertain in the political sphere. But
we only have a second left, but we're in these very contentious political times. Mm. And literally, we have 15, 20 seconds. How does it compare, do you think, to what Lincoln was going through in the Civil War?
Similar, but not as bad. I think, you know, at that time, the contention meant 10 or 20,000 deaths a day. So thankfully, we're not there yet. But the confusion and the polarity and everything was very similar.
George Saunders is the author of Lincoln in the Bardo. It's his latest book. It's his first novel, and it is a New York Times bestseller. So lose the modesty. Just shine.
Yeah,
bask in your own glow.
I have a lifetime of low self-esteem to work with.
He's speaking at 10:30 this morning and 8 o'clock tonight at the Halton Theater. Information on our website. That's at CPCC, by the way. Our website at WFAE.